last Monday, the time that we spent together, really I tried to suggest a couple of things, just very, very briefly, review. One was the, to me, the necessity of having joined together the idea of the ideas that Paul has expressed in the 12th and the 13th chapter of Romans. The 12th chapter being a chapter in which he speaks of the transforming power of the love of Christ in us. That is, the transformation that occurs when God's power coming from the outside imposes itself and willingly or unwillingly changes our lives. I stress this again because I want to use this as a contrast with some other things that are being said. I used a little diagram to indicate this idea Monday morning, and without going through the entire process again, and perhaps without any real hope of having it understood this quickly, I'd really like to put it back on the board once more for you to look at. I was suggesting that what Paul is really talking about in the 12th chapter is something that the social scientists today would call cognitive balance, meaning that when one's own sense of cognition, his appreciation of the world around him, is thrown out of balance, something happens that he doesn't expect, so that he's no longer comfortable with his environment, but then he must change. Now, the simplest illustration of this would be that if you step on a piece of iron, you're uncomfortable in your environment, and you move your foot. The more subtle sort of thing is that when you throw a stone at your enemy, and you expect your enemy to throw a stone back at you, if he throws a stone back at you, this is what you expected, everything is in balance, this is the way it ought to be in terms of your anticipations, and you don't bother to change your attitude toward your enemy at all, for the simple reason that this is the way it's supposed to be. Everybody knows eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. It's perfectly human nature, you see. But if the enemy does some stupid thing, like Paul is talking about in the 12th chapter of Romans, and feeds the hungry enemy, or gives water to the thirsty enemy, this is unanticipated. This is not the way that the enemy is supposed to behave. And as a result, you're thrown quite off balance in your cognition or your appreciation. And therefore, you must adjust to this situation by changing your own attitude in reference to this person who is your enemy. I tried to illustrate this with this little familiar diagram, the triangle here on the board, and to repeat that again just very, very quickly so that you can get the context of what I see that Paul is trying to say here. I use, for example, the illustration of world peace and thought of Nikita Khrushchev and all of us good people in the U.S. Now, we all know that we are all in favor of law and order and peace and harmony and so forth. And we all, of course, know that Mr. Khrushchev, or Red China, if you prefer, or whoever your favorite enemy is at the moment, is out of harmony with peace and law and order. They don't like it. And we all know from our simple course in mathematics that a positive times a negative will always give us a negative relationship. Therefore, the man who does not like those things that I like is a person that I don't like. Contrary-wise, any person who likes those things that I like, positive times a positive will always result in a positive force. Any friend of my friend is a friend of mine. Any enemy of my enemy, any man who hates my enemy is a friend of mine, you see, this sort of thing. Now, to change the relationships that people have in reference to each other, or in reference to values in the world, and this is what Paul is talking about as I see it in the 12th chapter of Romans, requires that you do the unexpected, that you feed the hungry enemy, which is out of the normal course of human experience, and therefore upset one's cognition, one's anticipation of the inputs from the outside. So in so doing, Paul says, you'd be heaping coals of fire in this person's head. You make him so doggone uncomfortable, he's got to move. This is the way that attitudes are changed in reference to these things. And so if the day comes that Mr. Nikita Khrushchev announces that he is all in favor of world peace and harmony, law and order, a positive times a positive is supposed to equal a positive. And I can no longer hate this man, per se. He can no longer be my enemy. I am uncomfortable with this relationship, so uncomfortable, my balance is so upset that I've got to do something to change it. Now, there's something that I can do about this to throw myself back into balance. One way that I can restore myself back into balance is deny that I am in favor of world peace and say that I hate peace and I love war. At this point, I am back in balance. A negative times a positive equals a negative. And I'm very happy. My anticipations are working on beautifully, and I don't have to change my attitude toward Nikita Khrushchev at all. I can go right on happily hating this man and be very comfortable with it. Trouble is, it's very difficult for us to lie to ourselves. So I've got to admit that I like peace. That leaves me out of balance. I could, if pressed hard enough, say that I like Khrushchev. That's a thought that is rather repulsive to me. I'd rather leave that negative for a moment. What do I do then? And this is what I do when I read the newspapers today. In actual matter of fact, I read the newspapers and Nikita Khrushchev says he's all in favor of world peace and harmony, and I say that the man's lying. Positive times a negative is a negative. This is the same thing that happens to a nation like the United States when we send a couple pockets full of grain to India and say, look, you starving rascals. How good we are and how we love you with our overwhelming generosity of some surplus grain that we couldn't get rid of anywhere else. Don't you see how we love you and we want to take care of you, and shouldn't this be a positive so that we'll love each other? And the Indian native looks at that gift and says it's a gift of necessity, it's a gift of self-preservation. They are afraid that we'll overrun them and destroy them. There is no love in this gift. And the love which is being confessed is not there at all, and therefore he remains in balance, quite out of harmony with our way of doing things. This was the first suggestion that I tried to make on Monday about the 12th chapter of Romans. The point being that the 12th chapter and the 13th chapter of Romans must always be taken together, I think, because having then immediately said that the Christian must be the nonconformist, the man who will not be squeezed into the mold of the world around him, the man who will not conform to this kind of a pattern, but rather one who is transformed by the love of Christ acting from the outside. When God gave me his laws and said, keep these, and when I did not keep them, and therefore what God loved, I hated, and God then had to hate me in a deterministic world. God had to hate me and punish me. Punish. That's what I'm going to be talking about the rest of this morning. That's why I'm doing this. God had to punish me, you see, for disobeying his law. He is, after all, a just God. Last night, in closing vestries, Manfred prayed for justice and for those who were denied injustice to be given justice. And I'd like to suggest this morning that neither he nor the rest of you fatheads have the least idea what that word means. And that if you knew, you would scream in horror and run in sheer fright at the concept of justice because you hate it. Deep down in your hearts, you hate it. You see, this is what I'm about to suggest to you. Well, Paul follows the 12th chapter with the 13th chapter, talking about the Christian who must be the nonconformist, who is transferred, who is transformed in his own life to become an engine, to become a dynamic power in the world, to become himself a transformer. You see, to be a little Christ is to be a transformer. It isn't an inert quality, but rather it's a guy who is a yeast, who is a light, is a salt, he's a leaven, he's a bubble. He's a constantly changing force. This is why Paul, having said this, immediately goes on to say, but hold the fort now. You must also obey. The civil disobedience chapter of 12 is followed by the great obedience chapter of 13. Obey the law. Honor the emperor. If you wish to have no fear of the man who bears the sword, conform. Chapter 12, he says, conform. I'm sorry. Chapter 12, he says, be a nonconformist. Chapter 13, he says, conform. And at this point, if you're reading Romans, it begins to sound like Holden. where you hear the most blatant inconsistencies, where nonsense pours from every font, where you have UTEC rushing around saying, the important thing that Howie Hong said when he was here is that man is not determined, but rather that he is a self-determining body. And having gotten that firmly in your heads, Ricci comes along and says, it's all determination. It's the force that bears in from the outside that's important. And you transform the other guy by the force that you affect by your relationship to him. You are transformed by Christ. I know the weakness of my diagram. And what in the world have you people been doing since Monday who heard me put this on the board then? Why haven't you been after me for this diagram? Don't you see the defect in that? Or have you been good, solid Christians so long that you've stopped thinking? A place where you really think that there is such a thing as objective truth, that you can read it or hear it, or that it exists. One can hear an awful lot of nonsense. Well, then if this weren't bad enough by itself, we have a morning devotion by Karen in which he says what we really want are God-pleasing solutions, or if you like, answers to problems. Give us answers. Give us security. And Halverson dashes in here on Monday morning and assures us that it's the cross and the relationship, the experience of the cross is strictly a one-to-one proposition. That it doesn't have any undeviating form. That you can set out and say, there it is, behold, this fits all men. This is good for all users. I'm doing him an injustice, and that's perhaps because it's all right, because he follows me this morning. And if he feels like defending himself, I'll get my inning tomorrow morning. It's all right. But what I'm trying to suggest to you is that it isn't true. I don't care what it is you're thinking about, it isn't true. And this is where I got into my own area especially, which is the law. I'm a lawyer. I'm not a theologian. I'm not a social scientist. I'm a lawyer. And if I know anything in the way of my own specialty at all, it is this, that truth is a relative thing. And you're perfectly entitled to argue with me about this, and I hope that you will. This morning, I want to talk about two of the topics that I suggested that I ordinarily would have taken two separate days had this been a normal week. I gave them silly titles because sometimes silly titles will stay with you a lot longer than fancy scientific titles. The titles that I'd like to hang on to this one, first one is Let the Punishment Fit the Crime. Let the punishment fit the crime. Let the punishment fit the crime. Whatever the crime is, let the punishment be geared according to the crime. That's good sense, isn't it? Absolute nonsense, unchristian, despicable to let the punishment fit the crime. The other lecture that I wanted to talk about, and this one would have been the second in the sequence here, and we'll talk about them both in the same breath this morning, is the idea of not free, not white, and not 21. Not free, not white, and not 21. That is that law as a force in the world is always a negative limiting power. That you cannot talk about freedom in terms of man's law. That there is no such thing as freedom in terms of man's law. Thank God. If there's anything in the world that you hate more than justice, it's freedom. You cannot accommodate yourself to the idea of justice, and you most assuredly cannot handle the concept of freedom. Well, that should be disturbing enough to give me a toehold to start talking about it. So let me try now and defend some of the statements that I've been making, starting out by reading a little bit from the Epistle of Romans, 13th chapter. I'm about to suggest to you that what you now hear is not true. I have not said that what is written here is not true. I'm suggesting that what you now hear is not true, because you don't hear what is written. This is going to come to you only if you will live and experience what these words mean. It's the problem of communication. The only thing that saves Scripture at all, as I see it, and again, one can rejoice that we have theologians here to return us all to sanity. The only thing that saves Scripture at all, as I see it, is the fact that it is the living Word of God, and it's not static, it's not dynamic. I mean, it's not fixed. It doesn't retain this form, you say. Throw it away and rewrite it in your own words. Make it part of a living thought. Justice Cardozo once said that a word is nothing but the skin of a living thought. And now we're into the whole pattern of semantics. This is the 13th chapter. This is the chapter, the second of the two that I've been talking about. This is the one in which he says that the nonconformist must also conform. Paul, in his own way, setting up this ongoing tension between these two things, the attempt to compromise between left and right. As you can see, I'm reading from the New English. Every person must submit to the supreme authorities. There is no authority. There is no authority. For some years now, I have been a hearing officer for the Department of Justice in conscientious objector cases. In this position, I get to talk to a lot of people who object to military service because of a violation of their conscience as they see it. We have a lot of fun with this chapter, as you can well imagine. The man who will deliberately disobey his government. And then he must, of course, answer for himself, are you disobeying the will of God? The government cannot speak except by the will of God, is the suggestion that I make to him. He's perfectly entitled to hit me in the teeth at this point if he wishes to. What do you do with this sentence? There is no authority but by the act of God, and the existing authorities are instituted by him. Consequently, anyone who rebels against authority is resisting a divine institution. And those who so resist have themselves to thank for the punishment. And he doesn't say rehabilitation or correction or return to a normal status. He says punishment. P-U-N-I-S, punish, hurt, pummel, beat. Discipline, is that the same word for you as punishment? Discipline meaning Paul uses that word in other places. An athlete, for example, disciplines himself so that he can run better. A Holden hiker disciplines himself or herself so he can get up to the lake in better form. That's a nice kind of discipline. It's a soft word. It's an easy word. It's a lovely word. It's mother. I'm not so sure that's the word Paul is using here at all. I think maybe he's using a spit-in-your-face kind of word. Punishment, hurt. Punishment. You have only yourself to thank for the punishment that you will receive. He continues, for government, a terror to crime. And before this morning is over, you must answer me what the word crime means. For government, a terror to crime has no terrors for good behavior, and you're going to have to answer to me what good behavior means. You wish to have no fear of the authorities? Then continue to do right. Do right. It's one of these beautiful generalities. Do right. I wonder if any generality, whether it's found in the 13th chapter of Romans or whether it's found in the Constitution of the United States, is helpful in the least in resolving particular problems. Monday I suggested that the idea of all men should be free and equal is perfectly useless when you come to something like a negotiation and a bargaining sequence between labor and management. What good does the blatant generality that all men should be free and equal, what good does that do when you're trying to determine how many cents an hour a man should be paid for his work? You wish to have no fear of the authorities, then continue to do right and you will have their approval, for they are God's agents working for your good. But if you are doing wrong, then you will have cause to fear them. It is not for nothing that they hold the power of the sword. For they are God's agents of punishment, for retribution on the offender. It doesn't say for rehabilitation here, it says for retribution of the offender. That is why you are obliged to submit. It is an obligation imposed not merely by fear of retribution, but also by conscience. And I'm so happy that Paul put them both in the same sentence so that you can't try and duck by saying, well, that's just another way of saying acting out a good conscience. That's not what Paul says. Paul says retribution, fear of, and conscience. That is also why you pay your taxes. That's something that anyone can understand. The authorities are in God's service, and to these duties they devote their energies. I think that most of us like justice in the abstract. I very seldom have a client who wants justice. When a parent comes down and says that his child has just been picked up for slashing automobiles and they've hauled him down to the juvenile center and are doing something about it, the client does not ask me to obtain justice for his child. He wants to get him off. He wants to go down and have the child brought home with him. He doesn't want justice, because justice, I think, that most of you would define as being the equal-handed treatment of like cases. Everybody gets the same shake. Everybody's treated alike. There is no discrimination. That word discrimination, you know, is such a horrible word. Discrimination is such a beautiful thing. Discrimination is such a terrible thing. Discrimination is such a desirable thing. It's such a bad thing to discriminate against people. You can't possibly be a useful citizen in society unless you discriminate like crazy. I'm trying to suggest that life is full of these paradoxes, and the simple solution or answer that Karen was helping us look for this morning in devotions is a will-o'-the-wisp, that you must not be sidetracked by this idea that you're going to be told, that you're going to understand. Life will never be comfortable for the thinking person. Life will never be comfortable for any person. You will never have the luxury of knowing. Your life is always going to be filled with indecisions. It was at this point Monday that I tried to suggest that the lawyer is a little example of life. It is a microcosm, if you like, of life. Never does the lawyer have the luxury of knowing the answer to his problem, because by very definition, the only problem that the lawyer ever gets is one that doesn't have an answer. If the problem has an answer, it is not a legal problem. If you can find the answer to this thing by weighing it or measuring it or by running laboratory tests on it or by looking it up in the library, it's not a legal problem. People don't litigate about things that have answers. People litigate about things which have no answers. It's unknowable. Therefore, it is a legal problem. And therefore, it is something about which we must make a judgment. That's why we call them judgments. That's why we call them legal opinion. The motto which I gave to you Monday is as valid this Wednesday as it was Monday for lawyers, and that is, we are frequently in error, but we can never be in doubt. Of course we are, quote, wrong as many times as we are, quote, right. Why don't we resolve all legal problems by flipping a coin? If either answer is a defensible answer, why not simply flip a coin and be done with it? This is because that down deep in our hearts, we have the conviction that somehow or other, we muddle through to a better answer where we use our intellect and our hearts and our minds than in simply doing it by the flipping of a coin. I've been trying to insult everybody on staff this morning. And, Rudy, you got here late. See if I can think of something nasty to say about you. Rudy lives a relatively uncomplex and simple life, you say. His knowledge, while it is great, and his wisdom, while it is tremendous, is on a very simple level. He is able to go out and take rocks or sediments or something and bring them into his laboratory and crush them and break them up and pour acid on them and weigh them. And when he gets halfway through, if it doesn't work well, he can throw it away and say, oh, well, another month of my life wasted. He doesn't have to resolve that thing there on the penalty of death. That's not the lawyer's choice, and that's not your choice. The one thing that a lawyer or a judge can never do, and the one thing that you can never do in your lives where it is like a lawyer's problems, is to say, this is too tough for me to answer. That's the one problem. That's the one answer you cannot give. You must, at the risk of death, answer. We have an interesting statute in the state of Washington. It says if a judge refuses to decide an issue which has been put to him within 1 year, that we will withhold his salary until he decides the case. Now, you might wonder why a judge would refuse to answer a problem that's put to him. It's because in the throes of indecision, the inadequacy of the background material and the absolute impossibility of ever knowing what the truth is in this situation, he cannot bring himself to give an answer where he knows the possibility of error is that great. And judges are like Martin Luther. They would much prefer to take a whip and slink off to the cavern and beat themselves and say, my sins, my sins. I will minimize the exposure that I have to the populace generally. I'm going to minimize the opportunity for doing wrong. I won't answer. I won't expose myself to the possibility of error. I'll flee. I'll hide. Don't ask me those questions. They're too tough for me. I don't know the answers, and I can't figure them out. That's not the kind of luxurious life that you get to lead. How nice it would be to be completely isolated from life's problems. How nice it would be if we could all move in with Carol, with Carol, and have answers. All right. Let's see, I've got five enemies in the crowd now. I'll see if I can work on some more. This is not within the scope of what we are entitled to do, you see. You must guess. You must guess. Brother Halverson is perfectly entitled, next hour, if he likes, to lead us out of the impenetrable jungle here. He is entitled to bring us to an understanding, if he can. Brother Manfred is perfectly entitled to have justice for all people if he really wants it by the time we get through. If he really wants an even-handed disposition of the same punishment for the same crime, the same blessing for the same virtue, if that's really what you want by the time we get through, fine. That's good. I'm trying to suggest to you that it isn't so and you don't want it. I think I've also tried to suggest to you that discrimination, whether it's discrimination in on a basis of the color of a person's skin. This is a good way to get yourself stoned today, to say that you ought to discriminate on the basis of a person's skin. Basis on religious belief. It's a good way to make yourself unpopular, is to say that we ought to make distinctions on the basis of a person's religious convictions or his political convictions. If you don't have that much discrimination, if you can't tell one from the other, you're in pretty sad shape. Pretty sad shape. Now, I'm using the word in two senses. That is, a bad discrimination and a good discrimination. Something which is morally good and something which is morally bad. Don't you try and elude me that way. And incidentally, in about another 5 or 10 minutes, I'm going to be through talking and you're going to do the talking on some questions that I'm going to propound to you. Don't you try and elude me. For 15 years now, I've been chasing law students around law school classes, and they've been chasing me around in return. We've got a game. It's called Nail a Man's Hide to the Wall. You're entitled to try and trap me this morning. I'll do the same for you, my friends. You be honest. Now, if you're going to make the distinction between good discriminations and bad discriminations on the basis of whether or not it's morally good or morally bad, all you're doing is substituting one set of value determinants for another. And you're going to have to decide whether or not you really want the moral or the ethical or the, a good hate word out here, the fuzzy, the vague, the imprecise, the not definable. Do you want that as a basis for your determinations? Here's a place where Rudy and I can rejoice together and sympathize with Halverson and Henderley and the rest of these boys who have to deal. At least we can let the chips fall where they may. When we see a thing that looks like it is just like so, we can say it's just so. We start with no presuppositions. Don't have to. We're just looking for the truth. Hinderly, UTEC, Halverson, they can't afford to do that. They've got to start with a bunch of presuppositions. They can't afford just to go out and look for the truth. Because if they do, we're apt to excommunicate them. Whoever heard of a theologian going out and looking for the truth initially? This is a good way to get yourself defrocked. But would you want us, that's right, you can have your inning tonight. Would you want us to, I'm us now, if you forgive me, all you lay people, would you want us lawyers to conduct ourselves in this way? Would you want these theological values pumped into the way that we resolve cases? For example, this matter of one-to-one here. This is the opposite, you understand, of justice. Even-handed, the lady with the blindfold and the scales and the sword out here, you know, she weighs them like this, and if it doesn't come out even, that sword comes down. Point! I mean, there's no question of individual one-to-one business about here. Did you go over 35 miles an hour in a 35-mile speed zone? Boop! That's justice. You did or you didn't. It's real easy. It's just there at absolutes. I tried to suggest to you a long way Monday morning that law is not absolute. Law is very tentative. Law is a method. It isn't even a set of rules at all. Law has no absolutes. The person who thinks that law can be found in a law library by opening to a given page of a given book and looking for the rule simply doesn't understand the problem. There is no rules. There are no rules. The illustration that I used Monday about the words of a statute dealing with the award in lieu of homestead, read by the Supreme Court before which I practiced, to mean two diametrically opposite things inside of a few years of each other. This is because of the surrounding environment. The rules didn't change. I mean, the statement didn't change. The law, how I hate that way of expressing it. The statute, the semantics, this didn't change. It was simply the court's application. Law has no present tense. The law doesn't exist. Law is a recounting of history, what the court did the last time the case was before it, and it's a prophecy of what the court will do the next time that the problem is brought to it. It's my guess, it is my educated, informed guess about how men in authority will resolve a problem when it's put to them in such a fashion that they can't evade the issue. The favorite indoor pastime of all courts is to try and evade the issue. Find a way of avoiding the problem if you can. We have a nicer name for it. We call it jurisprudential economy. That is, you never resolve the issue unless it's absolutely inescapable. If you can beat it on a procedural point, if you can beat it on an evidentiary point, if you can possibly talk the parties into compromising the thing, if you can pass the buck to the legislature, if you can do anything else to avoid answering that unanswerable problem, do it. But ultimately, when you get to the place where you can no longer evade the issue in law or in life, then you must base your decision upon something. And at that point, you speak new. Precedent is helpful. Trying to evaluate what it will do to the surrounding circumstances, helpful. The words in a book, helpful. The Constitution, helpful, but not limiting. Would you want it to be limited? Or would you want to have this sort of individuated, every man according to his own needs sort of a basis? Andre Gide said this once. I've got this tacked up someplace around my office. The law in its magnificent simplicity forbids both the rich and the poor from sleeping under bridges. Some of my friends use this slogan as a means of showing the injustice of our society, because some of my friends, members of the faculty where I teach, good, competent lawyers, are so completely ignorant that they think they're in favor of justice. And so they say the law ought not to be so unjust as to state that both the rich and the poor are prohibited from sleeping under bridges. The law should individuate, they say, and treat each man according to his own needs. And I say to them, as I say to you, that's not justice. That's grace. And the law is incompetent. It's unable to handle grace and measure each man's reward or his punishment or his response to his needs in terms of his needs, because we can only let the gal wear a blindfold and be measured by sort of abstractions which are not individuated to separate people's needs. St. Paul is saying the same thing, isn't he? Yes. Do you want to fear the authorities? Would you have no fear of the authorities? Then obey the law. For the law is a terror to the man who is a criminal, not to the man who does good. This does not describe crime or criminal conduct. Now my questions. I suppose that you would concede that some people are better informed than other people, almost every phase of life, having had the advantages of a better education and so forth. Is ignorance of the law a defense if one does something which is prohibited by the law? We frequently say that ignorance of the law is no excuse. I mean, lay people say that. Lawyers would never say that. Lawyers would say everyone is presumed to know the law. And of course, a presumption with us is our way of saying that, of course, it isn't true. This is why we use presumptions in the law. We use presumptions when it isn't true and we know it isn't true, but we're willing to make the concession to inaccuracy in order to get the ball game moving. And so we would not say that you are, that every man is, that we would never say that ignorance is never an excuse. No self-respecting lawyer would say such a thing. He would say that you are presumed to know the law. Would you have it otherwise? Would you, for example, in criminal conduct, make a distinction upon the basis of whether or not the person knew that it was prohibited to do so and so? Punish him if it was prohibited, and not punish him if he did not know. Well, you say, isn't every man entitled to a defense, having it shown that he had the mens rea, the criminal intent, that he formed the intention to violate the law? And this is typically true of criminal law. You must not only have the act, the proof of the act, what was really done. It's the sort of thing that Perry Mason would call the corpus delicti. Most people think that's a stiff. It isn't at all. The corpus delicti is the body of the crime. It's the act which has been committed. It's the proof to show that you did the thing that it's been said that you did. That's not enough. It isn't enough. You must also show that the person went in there to do it intending. Now, don't jump for crying in the night. Don't act like a bunch of theologians. Steady here. Not intending to commit a crime, but intending to do the thing that he did. Intending to pull the trigger when the sights were on another man, whether or not he thought it was criminal or not. We have a lovely case in the state of Washington of an Indian who, driven by the will of Wendigo, shot another man who was an evil spirit. Well, of course, he had to shoot him. It's your duty to shoot them, these evil spirits. And he was an evil spirit, and the Indian saw him, and Wendigo said, shoot him, and he shot him. Can you punish a man for that? I didn't say that this man was insane. I said that, driven by the compulsion of his God, that he destroyed the evil that his God told him to destroy. He knew what he was doing. And he knew that he was about to bring about a death. and this is prohibited, and the corpus delicti was there. Is it a crime? Would you have it be one? Notice that we have both kinds in life. We have crimes in which the criminal intent must exist, and then we have some crimes where there's no need to have any knowledge at all, nor even to intend to do the thing that you did. If we had 30 hours for a criminal law class, I could explore that a little bit further with you. Right now, I won't. I suppose that you would concede for me that some people are, by birth, by the accident of birth, blessed with more goods than others. Would you have this element of wealth or non-wealth be taken into consideration? A man steals a loaf of bread because he likes the thrill of stealing. A man steals a loaf of bread because he's starving to death. Are these different cases, or shall we do justice? Shall we throw them both in the clink for 5 years? Or will you relieve from responsibility the man who steals out of hunger? During the famines in Calcutta in 1943, I watched people by the hundreds of thousands. There were 3 million people who starved to death in that city that spring in 9 months. So it's a lot of people. I watched people by the hundreds of thousands starve to death on the streets, sometimes groups of 50, 100, 500 in a group sitting quietly backed up against the building, starving to death with racks of open food in great quantity, sitting a few yards away in open market situations. I never saw a mob try to steal food. Watch, lots of people steal things. It's my own houseboy would steal me blind every time I tell him I was going to leave for a month or so. But I never saw a mob try to take food by force. Why not? Because of a sense of right and wrong, it's even more significant than preservation of life for the individual. Our law does not recognize in form the distinction that I've been giving to you here. Maybe it does in fact. Ever occurred to you that maybe that's why the jury exists, or one of the reasons the jury exists, is to temper the quality of justice? When we can't state it in a way that we think it's going to come out right, that then we do it the other way by cheating on the rules. And one of the most frustrating experiences that I've ever had was practicing before a complete idiot down in Tacoma. He happens to be a Superior Court judge. The books, the cases. The law was mine. There's no question about this. The Supreme Court, on repeated instances in the state of Washington, had announced how virtuous my client was. And I explained this to the judge, and he announced that I was about to lose. My client was about to lose. And I said, "Your Honor, you can't, the law." He said, "Young man, this is not a court of law, this is a court of justice." And I lost. Maybe I should have lost. Maybe I should have lost just because my client was a stinker. Because my client didn't, quote, deserve, close quote, to win. And do you like discrimination? Do you like to have judges decide whether or not a man's case is a good case or a bad case, whether he should be punished or not punished because of the cut of his jib, the color of his hair, the appearance of his face? Or do you want judges to be bound by rules which say if a man steals bread that's not his, he goes to prison? I don't care whether he was greedy or starving to death. No difference. Quality of law is not a quality of mercy. The quality of law is justice. It is God who says, "You have offended my holy law, and therefore you must be punished." That's so easy for God to say. Because God can say that you're sorry, confess your sins, and ask me for forgiveness, and everything is sunshine and light, and I can turn you back on the street, regenerated, rejuvenated, reborn, a Christian. It's so easy. God can forgive, but not quite so fast, my young friends. God will forgive the damnation that's involved in the wrong, but not the inevitable natural consequences. The long-term alcoholic may not be punished eternally by God, but his liver is still bad. Is that the distinction which is being made, you see, between the civil law and the and the law of the theologian, between the Christian law and the law of the judge who sits on the horsehair sack on the bench and tries to unravel these things. I go on. I suppose that you would concede to me that some religious practices have more utility in society than others. Shall we discriminate upon the basis of them? Or shall we separate church and state, like I'm hearing so much about today, so that there is no distinction made on this basis? For example, perfectly all right for people to decide how many wives they ought to have. Not in the United States it isn't. What do you think this is, a free country? You get one wife at a time. If you want to practice bigamy, you do it serially, boy. Not horizontally. Serial monogamy is our rule, not bigamy. Don't care whether or not God says that you should have a house full of wives. Not in the United States, you don't. You think it's wrong to eat blood? You think it's wrong to have a transfusion? Don't try to practice your religion in the state of Washington, my friends. We'll take you down to the judge and we'll transfuse you if you're sick enough, or your child, in the drop of a hat. By what right does the state interfere in your religious determinations? State ought to leave its hands off my convictions and my beliefs. Is that right? Then how come the Lutheran Church today in Minneapolis, Minnesota, is suing vigorously to decide to whom the property belongs? Why don't they resolve that problem for themselves? Why don't they bring it to the church council? I don't remember the church council. I know the truth. No one else does. I'll tell them. I could tell them just as well in the church council as I could on the bench if I were a judge. I'm no more susceptible to error in one place than another. The only place where I'm ever not susceptible to error, some of my friends tell me, is when I'm a member of the General Convention of the Church. And sometimes there I feel that I'm susceptible to error. Do consuls err? You good Lutherans? Is it possible for consuls to err? Well, you can answer that one along the line. But I suppose that you would concede to me that there must be some discriminations on the basis of religion. But we all know, at least, there must not be discriminations on the basis of such things as race. Do you know that Alaskans, Eskimos, get tuberculosis much more rapidly than most other people do? It's a genetic quality, at least temporarily, so maybe it can be bred out in a few years. But they are more susceptible, and some other people are much more susceptible to other kinds of diseases. It may be that some of us genetically have certain inclinations that may make us weaker than others. Shall we make distinctions on this basis? Shall our laws be adjusted in such a way that it protects this group from things which this other group is entitled to do as a matter of Christian freedom? Simply because it's more deteriorating to the first group than it is to the second? Or will you refuse to make discriminations on the basis of race? I suppose that you would concede to me that some 16-year-olds are a lot more mature than other 16-year-olds. The law doesn't know anything about this. A person is an infant until he's 21, and then bang, at the stroke of midnight preceding the day of his 21st birthday, he becomes endowed with all wisdom and is a man who makes all his own determinations. And we don't make any distinctions between the big boy and the little boy. Between the smart one and the dumb one. We don't make any difference between the well-trained one and the one who is not well-trained. The law in its magnificent simplicity prohibits them all from sleeping under bridges. I mean, you are now talking about a wonderful vehicle, the law, a vehicle that was able to take the American Negro and breed him like cattle through years of century, where the father and the mother of a child never knew each other in marriage, where we split the family in all directions. And then one day we proclaimed that they were free and equal, and we endowed them by act of Congress with all the virtue and traditions and all the respect for marriage and legitimacy of children. And we said, now why don't you behave like we do, see? 3, 4, 5 centuries of experience to the contrary, enforced by us by whip and by sword, ignore it all. Why don't you grow up overnight? Congress just told you to. Well, we do the same thing with kids. Boy, if you are a juvenile delinquent in the state of Washington, you are fortunate. We can protect you. We can give you the full support of the juvenile court. A pat on the back. That's what we'll give you. Just like an elephant patting an ant on the back. We can squash you for good. drive your car once too fast and let us decide that you need rehabilitation. And you know, if you were an adult offender and drove your car too fast, we would give you a $2 fine or a $5 fine, and then we would turn you back on the highways. You would have paid the price. You would have been punished. But if you're fortunate enough to be a juvenile delinquent, we will rehabilitate you, even if we have to keep you behind bars for 8 years. This is because it is a one-to-one relationship that we develop in the juvenile court. It is a sensitive thing where we are out to rehabilitate the individual. No longer in the juvenile court do we make the punishment fit the crime. We make the treatment fit the needs of the person who needs our assistance. Now, when you get to be an adult, and then you can read in the book what the punishment is, and that's the punishment you'll get. But if you'd like to have one for one, if you would like to have this personal relationship, then be a juvenile so that we can rehabilitate you rather than punish you. By what right really does society, through its laws, intervene in your life or my life? By what right does God interject himself into my life? By what right does the state interject itself into my life? Paul says that Governor Rosalini is an agent of God, acting for my benefit. Sometimes I think God is pretty careless about the people he chooses to be his agents. I didn't vote for him. Is that the source of authority? Is the government really God's agent? Government always, invariably, God's agent? Well, of course, you know that isn't so. And how quickly and how ably we run from our traditions here to the safety of the magic distinction that resolves all these problems. So long as the government is doing God's will, we obey it. When they stop, we stop. God must be obeyed rather than man. That's so easy. Try it in the courtroom sometime. Oh, that's too complicated. All right, try it in my office sometime as a special hearing officer for the Department of Justice. Young man, why don't you go to war? Because it's wrong to kill people. It's wrong to bear arms. What makes it wrong? God says it's wrong. Young man, are we not entitled to protect ourselves from our enemies? Yes. Could you protect yourself and others from your enemies in some circumstances? Yes. Others, no. Would you protect others? No. If your house was being broken into by a man who was intent on destroying you and your family, would you call the police? Certainly I would call the police. How come? I pay taxes. This is the policeman's job, and I pay him for this protection. Therefore, I would call him to protect me. Could you be a policeman, carry arms, drive off the intruders? No. It's wrong. Is it wrong for the policeman? No. It's his job. You mean if I get paid for prostitution, it's all right? Oh, no. No, that can't be true. But it's all right if the policeman is paid in order to do the thing which is wrong. For him, it's all right. Oh, I see. Right or wrong is merely what you think about it. No. Right or wrong is what God's word says, and that's what I believe. What do you believe, young man? Could you be a policeman or could you not? No, I could not. My conscience would not permit me. Then why do you call a policeman and ask him to do sin? That's the question. And there are thousands like it in the brush. God's will stops at the point where I would have to carry the gun and wear the badge, but it's all right where you have to wear the badge and carry the gun. That's not against God's will, but it is for me. Oh, the illustration which I've just given you is a gross illustration. Your problems, because you are more sensitive to the word of God, are much more refined. But they are still lines that are to be drawn. And you can't draw such a line. Truth, if it exists, This is where you come in next hour when I stop in a couple moments. Truth, if it exists, exists at the North Pole and the South Pole, and we live there. And every time we say yay, it's got a lot of nay. And it's always an adjustment of it's kind of good and it's kind of bad. And this morning, I think this is more gooder than it is more badder. And so I'll do it this way. You're perfectly entitled to join my ranks and say that I'm frequently in error in my judgments here, but I'm never in doubt. And I think you're joining Martin Luther at this point, as I would see it. But I'm not quite so sure. Why do we really have a criminal law at all? And what is it that we do with these people after we get them away? Is it punishment, in fact? Are we to bear the sword as agents of God for retribution for the man who gets out of line? Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. How do you square that one? Oh, the state should never punish a man. The state should never punish a man. The state should only correct him. It should only be rehabilitation. Are you entitled to rehabilitate a man who doesn't agree with you? You know, I am convinced from the little experience that I have had on these wonderful things called interdisciplinary studies and projects. Next week I will be engaged in such an interdisciplinary project with a bunch of people who work with offenders in prisons and reformatories and so forth. And there with my colleagues from the Department of Psychology and Psychiatry and Social Work, all the rest of these wonderful people with whom I have very little in common because they work with individual human beings the same way that Dr. Vinge would be trying to make a leg straight or a stomach well. I don't. I work only with the relation between two people. That's all. I don't care whether my client goes out a better or a worse man professionally. I'm just going to rectify the situation in which he operates. That's all I'm entitled to do legally by the force of the state, is to work in the environment. Man's own sense of values must be developed by himself, some other guidepost, not mine. I'm not going to give him those values as a matter of law. I'm not going to tell my client where right and wrong is. I'm not going to tell him what's true and untrue. I'm going to say, here's a rule we've agreed to abide by. So it isn't the best rule in the world. Who cares? It's a rule. Here is a way of maintaining peace. The illustration that I used for you Monday, I would like to repeat now. How do you run a lock at a canal? Do you have the barge captains, when they arrive simultaneously, slug it out of the fist fight to see who's going to go through first? That's a poor way to run a canal. Set up some regulatory procedures so that you say all pleasure craft go before all commercial craft. Maybe that's wrong, but it works, more or less. All right, then that's real easy. Our law should all be measured in terms of its utility. Oh, no, wrong, absolutely wrong. That's what Germany tried. That's what Hans Kelsen said. If it serves the purpose of the state, it's right. If you've got to kill a few million Jews in order to serve the purpose of the state, good. That's the third alternative, you see. If your justification for intervening in my life is not because you're going to punish me, and if it isn't because you're going to rehabilitate me, then it's because you're going to protect society and further its causes. And so if you protect society, boy, that's the best justification I ever heard for capital punishment. You know what it costs to keep a felon alive in prison for a year in maximum security? At least $8,000 or $10,000. That's the $8,000 or $10,000 that we don't get to put into something important and useful, like higher salaries for law school professors. See, that's the $10,000 that you don't allocate to the useful things in life, to preserve this one miserable convicted criminal who has killed 25 people, executed. He'll never do it again. That's the best protection you can get. Or is it necessarily destructive of society? Must we expend this money this way in order to be Christians? What's the problem? Is there an answer to that problem? Or is this relative? Is this a relative thing? Does it depend? Can you say yes or no, or does it depend? Listen, we've got a beautiful bridge going into the city where I live, Seattle. It goes across Lake Washington. It's a floating bridge. I'm sure that many of you have seen it. Next time you see it, let me ruin it for you. as you go out there and this Y develops, this is the place where they're now going to have the span. You see, here's this floating section. And float back in here, and then you've got the open parts of the ship that go through. You've got to make that curve. You know, those of you who have read the newspapers around Seattle, that there are almost a predictable number of people who will run into those bulkheads during the course of a year and be killed. It's almost statistically predictable. We have another new bridge. You have to pay toll to go across that one, so we don't. But I did once on the opening day. It was free. That bridge has no Y this way. It's got a different arrangement where they jack up part of the bridge and slip the other part under and let the ships through, and then it comes back down, levels out, and you go straight through. Nobody killed on this one. It's a very simple thing for me now to ask my engineering friends how many dollars it would take to take this bulge out of the old floating bridge and put in the nice straight one so that we wouldn't have six people a year killed on that curve. It's just a matter of dollars. Of course, we would never put a price tag on a human life. And even though it costs $1 million or $2 million or $3 million, we will happily pay the cost to take that bulge out of this bridge so that these poor people will not die next year. In a pig's eye, we will. It isn't worth it. Let them die. Should drive more carefully. We'll put up a sign. It says, caution. We haven't got that much money. We think the state of Washington is made of, anyway. Men? Oh, I'm being too hard on us. It would be better to say that we are making a wiser allocation of our available funds. We are using our limited resources to do other things which are more important. And that makes a big difference, doesn't it? Well, with some criminals, shall we execute them because we have better uses for our money? You know, in the state of Washington, we not only have people in prison for life, that means about 18 years. We also have a number of people this morning in any one of several of our institutions who are lying on the floor, unattended, unable to take care of themselves. In these same institutions, we have water heaters that are not capable of generating enough hot water to wash their soiled clothing adequately so that they are ill. This is because we don't have enough money to pay for them, I say. Because we are a poor society. We are poor people. And we must keep criminals alive because it's cruel to execute them. And it is. I'm not trying to say that I'm in favor of capital punishment. I'm not. I hate and detest capital punishment. I hate punishment generally. Sometimes I wish God were not just. You see, I also could get angry about God at this point. And I could say this is not justice, whatever justice means. That God is cheating because his salvation is so cheap. It's an easy out. It's a figment of my imagination. Just because I want to think of it that way. It isn't true because it isn't true that way in life. Oh, all right, drive me away from that answer. And then I must say, well, then this life cannot be like that life. I as a lawyer cannot be as a Christian. I cannot individuate my justice. I cannot as a judge say, I will give this man a sentence and this man no sentence, depending upon what his needs are, because this would be a law of men. This would be a government of men, not a government of law. You're going to insist that I, as a lawyer, at least be just and be even-handed in my treatment. And you're going to insist that there be some public offenses called crimes where we will punish a man or rehabilitate him or at least protect society. I'm through. We have a few minutes. Perhaps we'll have a little.